This is The Topic is Trek, episode 40 for Friday, March 15th, 2019. Talosian Lautrec.
Welcome to The Topic is Trek, the podcast that runs on impulse power. Join us for a journey where no show has gone before. If it has to do with Star Trek, there's a good chance we'll talk about it. Sooner or later, because on this show, the topic is Trek. Engage already!
Ba-ba-bum. Oh, song's over. I guess I gotta start talking now. Well, hello, everyone. I'm Clinton Allvord, one of your Topic is Trek co-hosts. And beaming in to join me, first of all, is Mr. Chuck Tomasi.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello. But I know what you'd be expecting. Not this week. We have a special guest joining us this week, Mr. Gary Lindros.
Hi, everyone. I'll try and mispronounce as much as possible to make you feel at home.
Excellent.
And the tip-off was Craig usually gets introduced first. I have bottom billing.
I was instructed by Craig to refer to you as his stunt double. So if that's
I can live okay with that.
You. All right. Fair enough. And how has everybody been these past couple of weeks?
Busy, really busy. I've been catching Discovery at off hours, really off hours, like right before I fall asleep off hours.
Oh my. Yeah, I've asked you a couple of times. Oh, so have you seen the episode? Because I want to talk about something. No, haven't seen it yet.
It's like 5 days later. No. We are coming into really busy time of year because we've got our annual conference coming up, and the to-do list just keeps getting longer while the snow in front of the plow keeps piling up. People keep throwing more snow in front of it. That's my analogy this year.
I was going to say, you moved to Arizona and you're still doing snow analogies?
Hey,
really?
I grew up in Michigan and Wisconsin. The snow plow analogy still resonates with me.
Oh, and how things go by you, Gary?
Oh, things are going quite well. I'm getting ready to go on a, unfortunately, non-Star Trek cruise tomorrow. So,
Oh, cool.
Darn. But, he's going on a cruise, but it's not Star Trek.
Well, you can't have everything.
I can still call like somebody captain, so it might not be, you know, I'll pretend.
Well, you can call us captains if it makes you feel, get in the mood for the trip.
No, it doesn't.
No. Okay. Never mind. All right. In that case, we're going to do our normal bit here. We're going to do some subspace chatter where we talk about the latest news in Star Trek. We've got a couple of breaking stories there. We'll try to put those back together again because, it was broken when we got in here. Then we're going to do our main topic. This time we'll be talking about the two latest episodes of Star Trek Discovery. And then, of course, we have our Warp Speed Roundtable. And this time it's a little different because it's going to involve a listener question. All right, Charlie. Is Charlie X on deck? Because we're going to open up subspace chatter.
You don't need all that subspace chatter.
Charlie, I keep telling you we do. Please, you've got to get with the program.
Let me push the button. Let me push the button. There.
All right. Is it you feel better now?
Charlie away.
All right. Well, Chuck, you have the first story to take us into the world of books.
All right. From PR Newswire, we have Los Angeles article dated March 4th, 2019. New this week, these are the voyages Gene Roddenberry and Star Trek in the 1970s, Volume 1 from Jacobs/Brown Press is the fourth installment in the heralded series of the books about the development and legacy of, yes, you guessed it, Star Trek. This latest volume delivers surprising revelations concerning the decade-long fight to resurrect the series after its 1969 cancellation. Oh, here we go.
My goodness.
No, not that one.
No,
this
wait,
one.
Wait, what? What? Wait, what? What?
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, it was canceled in 1969. That's a spoiler for some.
What?
Oh, jeez.
Let me do a spit take. Now. Hold on.
We should start a fanzine.
We should. I got a mimeo machine in the basement. Come on, let's go.
A key part of the story is Gene Roddenberry's struggles against studios and networks, which severely compromised his health. Quote, "I was stunned as I went through these letters and memos," said author Mark Cushman. "My heart went out to Gene Roddenberry despite Star Trek's remarkable popularity. Gene didn't see any of his promised 25% profit participation. And as he fought to bring Star Trek back, he was usually ignored or disrespected by those in charge." As the 1970s progressed, the show's legions of fans fueled a Star Trek boom.
Boom!
Thank you, Clinton.
You're welcome.
Well, I was also for the fandom and bringing it
boom
back.
Boom or cartoon? Sorry.
Syndicated repeats of the episodes dominated the time slots over 150 U.S. cities, and in 70 foreign markets, merchandising hit unparalleled levels with the sales in the millions, and fan conventions attracted tens of people. I mean, tens of thousands of people.
There we go.
And Associated Press reported, well, the first ones only attracted tens of people. They were in people's houses.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, but the first New York Con was like massively over, crowded. Yeah.
They described one gathering as like Beatlemania.
Yay! And Chekhov had the haircut for it, so it was great. Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of interesting stories in here. The more we find out as the years go by about the various struggles that were going on behind the scenes about Trek and the actors and residuals and the failed attempts to restart, the show and just all over the place. I can see we could fill several volumes as this author is doing with stories about Trek and its history.
A fascinating insight, if you want some of this, is from the files of Gene Roddenberry. I know we've plugged this podcast before, but the Trek files with Larry Nemechek is very insightful. He picks up real articles that, Rod Roddenberry is now the curator of all this stuff. And he pulls these out and he reads a letter, and it might be some pre-TNG stuff. It might be some post-TOS stuff. It's just this random piece of paper. And then he talks to, former writer or producer or it's a costume designer about that article. And it's really, really kind of fun that these people are still around to relive that. So there's my plug for the Trek files.
Indeed. Indeed. Actually, we'll be mentioning that again very, 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 very soon.
Sorry, I didn't mean to steal the thunder.
No, that's okay. I thought it was very topical, though, also of this, even though this is a book about the 70s, that they have a reference to, Halloween in here? Because you've got the mask, the Shatner mask on the cover.
Those masks are book. Darn creepy.
They are.
And Shatner mask. It's like, ugh. Go rob a bank with those things.
All right. Well, we talked about a transition into the next story, and let's go for it. Star Trek Mystery Solved. And this comes to us via TrekMovie.com. ISIS actress from Assignment Earth identified.
Now, we're not really? Talking about, weren't we just talking about this a little while ago? That nobody knew who she was?
That's right. Well, it's a Star Trek mystery. One of the most memorable performers from the second series finale of Star Trek, the original series, had no lines and shared billing with a cat, but is still enduring to this day. That season finale, entitled Assignment Earth, was a sort of backdoor pilot from Gene Roddenberry as a backup plan in case Star Trek didn't get a third season. And some days we wish it didn't. It was a time travel show with the Enterprise traveling back to 1968, the year the second season was on the air. I think you see how they saved money there. The focus of the episode was on the mysterious character Gary Seven, trained by aliens. Not the guy that's on the show with us tonight.
They saved money in the voyage home, too, by going to San Francisco in the late 80s.
Yes. Trained by aliens to save the Earth from itself. Gary's consistent companion was a shape-shifting pet cat named Isis. While Isis seemed to speak telepathically with Gary Seven, the actress who played Isis in her human form never spoke. As such, she was one of the many extras who was never credited, leaving her identity a bit of a mystery. It turns out, as you go through this article, and we'll talk about the link to the article very shortly, that first of all, you had an actress that people thought, well, maybe it's this actress here, and that actress didn't really do anything to dissuade people from thinking that, but later on in life, she said, no, that wasn't me. So apparently the credit had gone up on Memory Alpha crediting that actress and then went back to unknown again. But we were speaking about the Trek files. Well, our good friend Larry Nemechek was going through some paperwork associated with that episode, the call sheet from Paramount Pictures for the day shoot when the scenes were shot. And he was able to track down one particular actress who was listed, and that was April Tetreault, who has confirmed that she indeed was the human form of Isis.
You know what's so funny is I still see people cosplay this from time to time.
Indeed. Well, it's sometimes hard to tell with the cat ears. Are they doing that character? Are they doing, you know, just the cat ears are very prominent these days. Don't know which is which, but in this article, there's a picture of Larry with April, which is cool to see. And I want to mention right now that we have a link to this article, as well as all the articles we're going to talk about in the news. If you go over to the show notes for episode 40 over at thetopicistrek.com, you'll be able to see this article and see April and read the entire article about all the sleuthing that went about in this. So good work, Larry, in tracking this one down.
He's got a copy of the call sheet with one cat girl. Yes. And her name is on there. 2915 base rate. That must be an hour, I hope.
Yeah, well, that was the day rate. But apparently because she had to be there for extra stuff for the fitting of her costume, it was adjusted up to $81.51. So, you know, got a little bit something off of it, but certainly no residuals.
You get the mystique and the lore and then now newfound celebrity.
That's right.
I'll look for her at the next convention.
Indeed. Well, it looks like she was at a convention in this, in this picture with Larry. So, or was that his? I don't know.
It might be his house. I don't know.
Maybe so. Too many Star Trek figures. It must be his house. All right. We're going to go from there to some interesting news about a project that we have mentioned several times over the past year or so here on The Topic is Trek.
Vulcan, Alberta, Canada?
No, not Vulcan, Alberta, Canada. Although this may end up in Vulcan, Alberta, Canada. Who knows? But Gary, tell us about it.
Oh, yeah. And as a funder of this project, as well as being in the middle of a Deep Space Nine rewatch myself right now, I'm thrilled to talk about this. Shout Studios has acquired the distribution rights to What We Left Behind, looking back at Star Trek Deep Space Nine. According to Deadline magazine, Shout plans to distribute the documentary across multiple platforms by the end of the year, including a theatrical release.
Ooh.
This film is an in-depth look at Star Trek Deep Space Nine, often considered the black sheep of the Star Trek family. The show premiered in 1993 as a spinoff of Next Generation, with Patrick Stewart guest starring in the debut. Colm Meaney from Next Generation was also on the show as a regular, and even Worf jumped in after Next Generation ended and joined the Deep Space Nine cast as well. Rick Berman and Mike Piller created Deep Space Nine, and then handed it over to Ira Stephen Baer, who became the sole writer. He co-directed the documentary, and he likes to point out that Deep Space Nine was this ongoing plot. It was not an episode of the week type of series, mm-hmm. and that felt that the serialized format was ahead of its time and continues to influence Star Trek productions to this day. So this project has just been growing. It's been crazily funded by 500 times the amount they asked for. They are even remastering original footage from the show for this movie. So it's a really cool project, and I'm glad to see it's getting even more recognition.
And that show format didn't just influence Star Trek. It influenced the entire industry. I mean, you take a popular show like supernatural. Look at the arc that thing has. Years of storyline in those things. That's from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, there were
5, Blake 7. Yeah.
Yes, I was going to say, you know, there were a few shows around that time, but certainly, you know, that was the era where we were having that switch to rethinking how the storytelling is supposed to go, which then led into, obviously, with Ron Moore involved, into Battlestar Galactica, and it's become the norm now to not have something that's just episodic.
Oh, and that was a severe break. The first season was very episodic. So as they moved to this format, it was definitely atypical Star Trek. So yeah, it was definitely break the typical mold that we were used to having.
Well, again, I think that's because somebody got the note from one of the suits going, no more Move Along Home episodes. And so they said, okay, we're not going to do that. So what are we going to do instead? Well, we'll tell a really long story instead. You know, how about doing that? Move Along
Home. You had to pick that one, didn't you?
I'm sorry.
That'll shap you in the head.
All right. Well, that was breaking news that just had come in our day of recording. The story that Gary originally had, and I pulled this switcheroo on him, was actually a video by Ira showing the facility where they were doing all the transfers of all of the film to make the high definition transfers of the Deep Space Nine stuff that's going to be in the documentary. And they also have all these, you know, the call sheets, the scripts, the notes, everything going on in there. So it's going to be quite amazing to see this thing when it finally comes out, and you won't have to, you know, you can go anywhere to see it. I'm assuming Shout will also distribute it. They are, if Shout sounds familiar to some people, they do lots of video releases. They handle the Mystery Science Theater DVDs that come out as well. Mm-hmm. So and they have a streaming service. So you'll be able to see this documentary anywhere near you.
Yeah, and just as a side note, it is nice because Deep Space Nine's remastering, like they did for the original show and Next Gen, was canceled because the Next Gen discs didn't sell so well. So perhaps this will actually let them get enough interest to actually redo the whole series like the other ones. So we can only hope.
That would be nice. That would be nice indeed.
Or CBS can cough up some money.
Well, they've got a lot of Star Trek things on their plate already. So I don't know. We'll have to see what happens.
It's a money machine, Gary.
But speaking about Star Trek, we just were, and speaking about the original series, which we kind of were, we're going to mash all that stuff together. I have no idea where this was going. I was trying to do a rhyme, and I said, I don't have any time to do a rhyme. Oh, I just did a rhyme. Okay. So
that was one of the weakest segues of this entire 40 episodes.
Well, the batteries are low in my segue, so I couldn't really take it away.
I got to work with that.
Please take it away.
From Bloomberg Law. Well, there's a tongue twister if I try to make it one. We now have a ruling on the Seuss parody, Oh, the Places You Will Boldly Go. A Star Trek-themed derivative doesn't infringe Dr. Seuss's Oh, the Places You'll Go, largely because it's transformative and serves a different market, a federal court ruled. Former Star Trek screenwriter David Gerrold defeated copyright and trademark claims by Dr. Seuss Enterprises, which owns rights to the late author's work, in a March 12th summary judgment by the U.S. District Court for the District of Southern California. Gerrold's book, Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go, purposefully imitated the poetry structure and...
And we have to sign up for more about the story, but which we're not going to do because we really don't pull a lot from Bloomberg Law on this show. There was another article that was just very technical, and I didn't want to make that the link that we had in the show. But essentially, they were saying that this is a differentiated market than the market that would be for the Dr. Seuss book. And so in addition to being transformative, that you're taking the original work and doing other things with it, that there's no confusion in the marketplace about who this book is aimed towards. You know, whether they were saying it's going to be for Star Trek fans, science fiction fans, and I'm thinking Dr. Seuss is kind of a crossover to everything, so that's a really tough one to to sell. So kudos to them for pulling that one off as fair use, and congratulations to David Gerald for getting that done. And I think he's talking about possibly doing a sequel to it. I think now that the path is clear, let's move on and do some more.
I'd be up for that kind of project.
Absolutely. I think it'll be, well, I don't think the book has ever seen the light of day. So I don't know what makes up the story that's in Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go. So has anybody heard a plot synopsis of the book itself?
No, but I was just thinking of like One Fish, Two Fish or Yertle the Turtle.
You could
adapt a lot of those to the Star Trek verse.
So like Horton, here's a cue. You know, that type of thing, right? Okay, I see where you're going with that. All right, let's go away from that right now because that was a terrible pun.
I want to hear what the listeners have to come up with, too.
All right,
a gold mine out there. We have creative listeners.
It's gold, Jerry, gold. So if you've got some ideas of Dr. Seuss books that can be converted into Star Trek-themed books, let us know the titles of those books, and we will disseminate them out to our fellow listeners and your fellow listeners to the show.
And we're going to beat David Gerald to the punch.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, you're gonna
and
have to,
then
you have to
sue
go through
him for
us
everything
now.
He's got.
That's right. All the tribbles. We got them all. All right, speaking about tribbles, this story has nothing to do with it. I don't know where I'm going with these segues this evening. Has nothing to do with anything. Oh my goodness, I should have.
So if you have better segues than this, write us.
And let us know. That's what happens when you shuffle around the stories at the last minute. Things just go awry all over the place. This next story comes to us from Geek Tyrant. Not like a person, the Geek Tyrant. This is the site, the Geek Tyrant. Check out these denim Star Trek Discovery inspired Starfleet jackets. These are definitely inspired by Star Trek Discovery. They look exactly like Star Trek Discovery jackets. The difference between these denim jackets and the ones on the show is there's no actual gold braiding and so forth on it. That is part of the darker denim fabric that's on the jacket itself, but they do have a color-coded zipper on the front.
Asymmetrical zipper, yep.
Yep, and as well as the asymmetrical collar. It appears to me that the badges are included that they have on them. And the press release says, suit up for battle and prepare yourself to discover new dimensions in the Starfleet 2256 jacket. Heavy denim secured with sturdy top stitching enables this durable jacket to withstand conflicts with Klingons or tiffs with a tardigrade. What is it, like a leprechaun? I have no idea. The signature angular style of the Starfleet uniform returns with the stylish Discovery additions of long geometric lines and shoulder line details. It's perfect for all your missions, whether it's a black alert aboard the Discovery or a routine landing party to the store. The sleek blue collar and the subtle details of stitching color and zipper allow you to flaunt your specialty under the radar. Pick gold for command, silver for sciences, copper for operations, or stealthy black if you work in Section 31. See you on board.
Or red if you want to go on a security mission.
Yeah. Now, you may ask, well, that's great. What is the cost of these things? And I thought it was listed in the article here. I went over to the site. It's $330.
Oh, heavens no.
What a bargain.
You're paying that much to bring double denim back in style. No,
you are. It's a fashion statement, and you're going to get it started by doing this.
Will somebody have one on the next Star Trek cruise? That's what I want to know.
Quite possible.
The question is how many will be on the next.
Exactly.
And we're going to go, you bought one.
Hopefully it's a very durable jacket, but for that kind of price, at least.
I haven't had a jacket like that since I went to Sears. No, sorry.
Ooh, it's a Sears sucker. You're the sucker that bought at Sears. There you go. All righty. On that bad joke, we're going to move on to our next article, which takes us halfway around the world.
Which half?
I don't know. The other half. I don't know. Down, over, you know. Under.
All right. Under. SciTech.org.au. That's from Australia. This 5th of April, put on your Starfleet uniform, grab your phaser and tricorder, and set a course to the Perth Observatory to celebrate the first contact with the Vulcans on Star Trek Day. That's right. April 5th is Star Trek Day because all our listeners already knew that. Our telescope operators will show you stunning objects that are in Federation space and a massive nebula, which is in the Orion Syndicate territory. That's a good way to put it. Experience our amazing night sky through the wide range of telescopes at our sky viewing nights. Our volunteers will take you on the grand tour of the Southern Hemisphere sky with a wide range of targets, including nebulous planets, dying stars, and enormous star clusters. There are prizes for the best adult and child costume, so put on your best Star Trek outfit and join the team at Perth Observatory on April 5th. There might even be a Star Trek character on site. You never can tell.
Ooh. Yeah, maybe Carl Urban is just, like, you know, hanging around and he'll go over there or something.
I did get to cross an item off my bucket list last October when I did see the Southern night sky for the first time in my life.
Was it dark?
It was fairly dark. I went with Philip from Australia, one of our old podcast listeners.
I've met Philip. He gave me Vegemite once.
We went to a store.
You remember him, I'm sure.
The Vegemite I bought in Australia is still on my counter, and I use it almost every day. So, yes, he's a wonderful fellow. And we went on a nice scenic Saturday coastal drive. And on the way back, it was getting dark. And I completely forgot that I had mentioned earlier in the day that I would love to see the Southern Cross. And it was one of those rare occasions where you could see all five visible planets in the night sky and the moon at the same time. So we stopped, and although we couldn't see the Southern Cross, we knew where it was because I had my app out and going, it's roughly over there, but there was a little too much light pollution. We were out in the middle of nowhere off the side of a highway, but that was fun. I truly enjoyed that, and it is a memorable experience.
Excellent, excellent. So I wanted to cover that story. I'm hoping we have some listeners in Perth. We don't know that, or nearby. But it's also cool to see when you have, you know, museums and so forth getting into that kind of spirit of things. So well done, Perth. Well done.
I think we should rope in a few people by saying there might be a Star Trek celebrity you never can tell.
Yeah.
The contract gets signed.
So April is going to go down there because she's going to, you know, the Isis, and she's going to the cat, and she's going to, you know, okay. Well, you got to cash in when you can, and you know, now's the time to get started.
Strike while the iron's hot.
Absolutely. Before we go on to our next story that Gary's going to read, Gary, I want to ask you, have you gotten your letter from Sir Patrick saying that you're going to be on the new Picard show?
We did.
Well, you know, I didn't want to brag, but they've said that they don't need me at this time.
Ah.
That means, like, they're waiting for, like, episode 3 or 4. So I'm already got the, you know, I figure they'll do flashbacks. So I got my uniform all pressed. I'm ready to go.
Right uniform. Don't show up as Captain America.
Yeah, that would time not work out so well. Well, if you're talking about being in the third episode at the earliest, then this story may not be as applicable towards you, but we think the listeners would like to know about it.
No, I don't know who to talk to now. But anyway, but what we are, of course, talking about is Patrick Stewart's new Star Trek series. They've recently announced that Hanel Culpepper will direct the first two episodes of the upcoming still untitled Star Trek series. This makes it the first woman in the history of Star Trek to direct a pilot or debut episode of a Star Trek show within the 53-year franchise history. All 13 feature films in the Trek universe have also all been directed by men. So that slot is still waiting to be taken as far as women are concerned. Culpepper is not new to the Star Trek universe, though. She has already directed two episodes of Star Trek Discovery. She also helmed the episode. She helmed the episode titled Vaulting Ambition in season one, as well as an upcoming episode in season two. Which, of course, is now currently airing on the subscription site, in case you haven't been listening to our show.
Yeah. Living under a rock.
The last 2 years.
That's a horta. That's not a rock. Okay. Just letting you know.
Hiding under a horta.
Yeah. And the article doesn't talk about this, but of course we also know that another Trek alum is directing in Patrick Stewart's new Picard series, and that is Jonathan Frakes.
Oh, he's the one I have to talk to.
Ah, there you go. Just speak to the beard. And he has been kind of on the fence about deciding whether or not he wants to. Oh, I see we've got a photo being shown to me by Gary. that completely threw me off. Whether or not Riker will be appearing in the new series, you know, depending on the day of the week you talk to him, he's a little bit more coy about whether or not that's going to happen. It sounds like if he were to appear, that it would be very quick, that he's not a recurring character. If we're to believe read between the lines of what he's saying, but well done on the first female director. We almost had the first female director of a Star Trek movie, except that Star Trek IV got at least temporarily canceled and we lost that director. So I don't know whether they'll have another woman come in for that the next time around, but we'll keep our fingers crossed on that one.
I wanted to see Jonathan Frakes do like a Stan Lee cameo in that show every once in a while.
Well, I just want to say the idea of Jonathan Frakes showing up in another Star Trek series is, you know, pretty unprecedented. So this would
be
quite a break in tradition.
Is Picard going to be just a scene on the holodeck? Is that what you're saying?
I'm still not sure about Enterprise at all. Not at all.
Yeah, we're not bitter. Not bitter at all. And we had some more breaking news that broke today. And I've been sweeping up news left and right, trying to get the glue out and put it back together again. But we have some casting announcement.
Yes, from TrekMovie.com. With production starting in a month on the new Star Trek series featuring the return of Sir Patrick Stewart, Australian newcomer has been added to the cast. This morning it was announced on Deadline and confirmed by CBS. That's important. That the Picard show has added another series regular. Australian actor and model Evan Evagora has been cast as the star alongside Patrick Stewart, returning to his Star Trek Next Generation role as Jean-Luc Picard. No details have been provided of the roles Evagora will play. Am I saying that right? Evagora? Evagora?
I would go with Evagora.
Evagora. It's Evagora. Sounds like a race on a planet somewhere. What role he will play? He joins Santiago Cabrera and Michael Hurd, both of whom were announced as series regulars last week when we didn't have a show.
You're starting to fill out this cast with people that we don't know what they do and what the show is about yet, but we're hearing lots of people that are going to be in this show.
Yep. His career is just getting started. He's only 23. That's the age of my youngest daughter. He had a small role in the Australian drama Secret City and is recently filmed a part for the upcoming horror comedy adaptation of Fantasy Island. Wonderful. Oh. According to his bio, he was born and raised in Melbourne, Australia, and his mother, Marie, is of New Zealand and Cook Island Maori descent, and his father, Christos? Starts with an X. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Immigrated to Australia from his homeland of Cyprus before transitioning to acting. Evagora interests focused on sports, included winning a state boxing championship and competing in football finals. Interesting.
Hey, I note here that he was in an Australian drama. So clearly he goes to Australia. And therefore, come April 5th in Perth, I'm stretching.
Maybe
it's him. Maybe he's the one who's going to be there. And then that'll be a really great guest star to have saying, I can't tell you what part I'm playing. I can't tell you anything about the show. You haven't seen me.
Why are you here?
A Star Trek guest before you're in a Star Trek show, though?
There's
some predestination paradox going on here.
That would be very unusual, but not impossible.
He's a time guest because, you see, saying time makes him a cool guest. Anyway.
He could just show up because he's a handsome young man.
All right. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to do two additional stories that have to do with the Picard show.
Spoiler alert.
Craig. Enough.
So I would say if you want to skip ahead, maybe by about 3 minutes, 3 or 4 minutes, if you don't want to be spoiled by this stuff, and some of it is rumor, slightly high rumor. But we'll start off with Picard Star Trek series character breakdown reveals teen Romulan and shady pilot. Jean-Luc Picard is getting some new friends as character breakdowns for the supporting cast of the as-yet-untitled CBS All Access Star Trek series have surfaced. After Patrick Stewart made the surprise announcement at his Star Trek convention that he was returning to the franchise that made him a household name for new adventures, further details were nowhere to be found. Stewart confirmed an approximate time frame about 20 years after the events of the final Star Trek The Next Generation film, Star Trek Nemesis, and suggested Picard would be a very different man. But beyond that, little was known about the project until very, very recently. And we talk about, with the story and behind-the-scenes crew taking shape, we're now getting a hint of what the on-screen crew will look like. That hashtag show has posted what are purportedly character breakdowns for the show's supporting cast. Seven characters are listed, some more surprising than others. A new version of the EMH Doctor, made famous by Robert Picardo in Star Trek Voyager, here referred to simply as Dr. Smith.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, the pain. Appear to be among Picard's crew, as well as a neurotic expert on positronic brains named Starton, which could very well hint at the return of a positronic brain Data. The other characters suggest a scope that could reach beyond the usual Starfleet personnel. The show sports a pair of duplicitous pilots, as well as a teenage Romulan boy. Allusions are made to some sort of artifact, which would line up with Picard's well-established affinity for archaeology. And perhaps most notably, information on what isn't to show up in the breakdown. Other than Picard himself, there is no mention of any other Star Trek The Next Generation characters. So I think we'd suspected that for a while. Mm-hmm. I want to get to the other spoilers, so in case people are coming back. The other one is, this one comes to us from comicbook.com.
Alert.
Exactly. Production Weekly reports that the new Picard series will begin production on April 14th. Still time to get to Australian back for that actor. It will film under the production title Drawing Room. The dates fit in with the mid-season production start suggested by the show's producers. Of note is that Production Weekly lists the show's title as Star Trek Destiny.
Not to be confused with Stargate Universe that had a ship called Destiny.
And apparently Destiny is one of the titles that they copyrighted before they started announcing all these shows. And Lower Decks was also one of those titles. So it lends a bit of credence to it. We don't know if that's actually the name. And I want to stop referring to the name now in case people are coming back.
You are my density.
Yes. So those are the latest rumors. I think since we're so close to the actual production beginning, I've got this feeling that very soon we'll know a lot more. And we're talking about probably a month and a half. We're going to get a ton more information, at least about who these characters are, just to whet our appetite, considering the fact the show won't be coming out until the end of the year. So those are the... Take them with a grain of salt, rumors about the Picard show, as we will continue to refer to it at this point. Okay, with that said, it is time to... Oh, but before I go off from closing up Subspace Chatter, I want to mention that, yes, we talked about a lot of stories. However, there are an additional 12 stories that we didn't get a chance to cover, including how the fact that Stacey Abrams is a Star Trek nerd, loving a tribute to Anton Yelchin, and many more articles. You go over to the show notes for episode 40 over at thetopicistrek.com, and you can read all these stories and keep you in all the news until the next episode of The Topic is Trek. All right, with that said, it's time to come back from subspace chatter. Close that up. Push some buttons.
That ought to do it.
A well-oiled
plasma manifold, yeah.
All right, time to head out on the main mission. We're going to talk about the latest two episodes of season two of Star Trek Discovery. So if you haven't seen those, we've got spoiler alert coming up for that as well. Spoiler alert. The first episode was Light and Shadows, and that had a story by Ted Sullivan and Vaughn Wilmot, teleplay by Ted Sullivan and directed by Marta Cunningham. The plot line of that one was Burnham goes to Vulcan. Oh my goodness, long day. Burnham goes to Vulcan in search of Spock. Wait a minute, that's a coining a phrase.
Hey, we could make that a movie.
We could, where she unearths surprising family secrets. In researching what is left of the Red Angel's signal over Kaminar, Pike and Tyler end up in a battle with time itself. Giorgio has a few tricks up her sleeve for Leland in Section 31. And then the second story is If Memory Serves, and the teleplay for that was by Dan Dworkin and Jay Beatty, and directed by TJ Scott. Plot synopsis: Spock and Burnham head to Talos IV, where the process of healing Spock forces the siblings to confront their troubled past. Stamets desperately tries to reconnect with the increasingly disconnected Hugh, while Tyler struggles to shed the crew's suspicions of him due to his past as Vok. All right, we have lots to talk about here. Is there anything anyone in particular just wants to leap in and say, hey, what's the deal with that? Or I like this, or...
Oh, yeah. Hey, there's a lot going on, and we're still disconnected from a lot of the plot lines.
Wait, they just, Saru's planet, they've just, like, literally had a complete revolution. They've genetically sort of modified or advanced his entire species to now be more aggressive, and we hear absolutely nothing.
About the planet itself?
Yeah, and they're in orbit over it still. And they just, they're just going to overthrow everything. And,
Saru's sister is there. Everything is fine. What are you worried about?
That's true. What was I thinking? I don't
know. Well, especially when you consider one of the things, especially in the second episode, If Memory Serves, you get this undertone or blatant indication that, you know, when the Kelpians aren't held back, they tend to go a little bit more on the aggressive side.
Yeah.
He wants to let this fight happen between Culber and Tyler, and he kind of is smarmy to Pike about the whole situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Where in the Starfleet manual is there about, you know, a dead man coming back and
and battling a half a Klingon? Yeah. It's like, okay, smart guy.
Wow.
Geez, we got to follow those regulations. So, yeah.
Well, plus we have the fact that, you know, we have this explosion of the time rift, and sure, Discovery gets away from it, warping out of orbit around the Kaminar right in from orbit, which of course is a big no-no, but did the time rift explosion affect the planet? Was it just in space? We don't know. So we were done with Kaminar, yet we hung around for a while.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that at some point will there be some communication between Saru and his sister about what's happening there, but
weren't they told to hang around? I mean, they said look for more evidence of the probe
they were told to do that.
Was that after they left?
They were supposed to stay and investigate, but then when they were done with that, they were going to head off to search for the shuttle and to find Burnham and Spock.
Oh, right, right. And that's when they said, no, hang around.
No, why don't you hang around here instead? You know, and if Burnham happens to contact you, then, you know, why don't you let us know?
Because that squid from the Matrix came and attacked their shuttle.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that modification of the probe made it look extremely like the missiles, I guess you would call them, that are fired at all the planets, destroying Earth and the Andorian planet. They had that same opening.
Yep.
Of stuff to come out of.
But only Spock and Burnham have seen that image, and they didn't get a good look at the probe that attacked Pike and Tyler.
I don't
think
they've seen it at all.
There's no connecting those two dots, but yeah, except for the viewer, we're going, oh, that looks really familiar.
Right. And that was also, I think it was in the first episode here, I thought this is a real bizarre leap of logic. Now, in the second episode, it comes about, but all right. So Saru sees that it's a humanoid figure in an environmental suit or some kind of mechanical suit. Mm-hmm. Immediately, the jump is that it's from the future because of technology. I'm thinking, haven't they run into dozens of advanced technologies? Why is it necessarily from the future? Is it because they were tachyons? I couldn't quite figure out how they leapt from A to Z on that one.
It moved the plot line along.
Right. Well, but I mean, in the second episode, it would almost be better as if they still didn't know. And in the episode, if memory serves, Spock says, no, it was actually human. Oh, all right. Well, then clearly there's another issue going on here.
Did he say human or humanoid?
No, he said human.
Well, Spock melded with the Red Angel.
I thought he said he tried.
He tried. He couldn't. There was a field around. He said, but he did get enough of...
Make an impression?
Impression that it was human inside there. But yeah, he didn't get a chance to actually do a meld. So I would have liked it to stay a little bit more nebulous until we got that news from Spock so now we really know that this is, we're dealing with somebody who's doing time travel, clearly.
And we have a new complication with Lieutenant Arium.
Yes.
Who got a computer virus or something?
Well, apparently
she caught something out in the cold.
Yeah, but something with SQL injections, which I thought was that was really weird. That one like leapt out of. That's the thing I wanted to talk to you about.
Yes.
Chuck, have you seen the episode? It's like SQL injections.
Did he really say that? And I'm like, what?
I'm so glad I took that training course. It'll pay off centuries from now.
Yeah.
You DBAs of MySQL have a job for centuries. Or it's like COBOL and refuses to die.
Yeah, that's my guess.
There's good news. And I think when I was first watching it the first time, my wife Bonnie was, I think she was confused thinking that Arium was somehow communicating with Section 31. And I thought too.
I thought she was the mole.
But
they just found them in the middle of nowhere and went, okay, hand them over.
Right. Well, I'm trying to figure this out because Arium gets this
signal
invasion, whatever it is, when she's looking at the data that's being pulled from the Discovery by that probe. Or what were these? So she's staring at that screen of all the flashing things, and those three red lights come on. And you see those reflected in right now. I don't know. Does that imply that it's Section 31 from the future that's doing this? And so they're told, or is it a case of whoever is trying to, if we've got people trying to, or entities trying to undo whatever the Red Angel is doing, are they saying, well, okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to infect someone on the Discovery and have them work with Section 31 to thwart the plans of what's going on.
Why does she only make noise when the camera is on her? Did you notice that?
There's a lot of noise in this ship.
When she's moving, when the camera's looking at her and she says something, it's like, brr, 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 brr. But
still trying to get used to the fact that it's a new actress.
Yes. Yes. And I was hoping this week from the previous episode where the episode where Arium is doing all the sifting through the data from the sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we're going to get to find out something about what or who Arium is. No. Oh, well, now she's a major plot thing. We're going to find out in the next episode. No. Okay. Well, she's a major thing in the next episode. Hopefully next week.
Well, according to the scenes, things go off the rails.
And it's sooner or later. And now I did go to Memory Alpha going, I just have to, there's no agreement on what that character is. Is it human? Is it an alien?
Cyborg?
Is it an augmented human?
Yeah.
There's no clear indication from, matter of fact, there's almost conflicting information from people about what that character is. Now, I don't know if the books or the comics are trying to go a direction and make it clear, but as someone who's just watching the show, I have no idea. You know, to me, if I was looking at it, it's an android. But I guess it's not an android because it's got a lot of emotion going on here. And so I don't know what Arium is, and I'm kind of curious to find out.
They really haven't given us any backstory on that character yet.
Yeah, we need another, 5 to 10 minute scene of Tyler sitting in the dining hall instead of getting any more background on her.
Yes,
I need 5 more minutes of him sitting there at that same table.
As my wife says, can he wash his hair? I don't know.
Hey, let's not judge the fashion styles of the future.
Well, Section 31, clearly. I guess that's why Leland has has shaved his head. It's like, I don't want to deal with this at all. So I'm just shaving my head.
Speaking of Leland, I'm really enjoying the dynamics of him and Giorgio and what she is doing and how that's going to turn out.
Not well for Leland, I have a feeling.
No, of course not. She is setting him up for a big fall.
Well, we like to think that because we've been shown so much of Giorgio, but I wonder if it would be a nice little flip of the cards to have him actually outsmart her.
Ooh,
yeah,
keep her in her place a little bit.
Sort of play possum and then spring it at the end and go, ha-ha, yeah, I got one over on
as
you.
As they talk about her having her own series, I don't think I'd want her to be the head of Section 31. I'd rather still see her out there, being more of an agent sort of thing. So I'm hoping that she doesn't sort of supplant him as, overall commander. I think I'd rather see her getting her hands dirty than giving orders.
Yeah, I'm hoping that's going to be the case if we have a spinoff that, she's not controlling the big picture, that she's, off on missions doing stuff. Mm. What do we think about the lighting the fuel to send a signal to Discovery when it seems to come as such a shock that Spock does it in Galileo 7, that mm-hmm. it surprises everyone. And apparently it's an old trick they teach in pilot school. Now, is that because no one on the shuttle went to pilot school, on the Galileo 7, because you've got doctors and an engineer and maybe they didn't go to pilot school.
And
I don't know.
The rest.
Yeah. I don't know. Just, it was weird to see it and then have it referred to in that way and go, but that's going to come up again.
Yeah. And people and will still be surprised. It could be that it's not used often. It's a last ditch measure.
Yeah, well, it certainly would be because in both cases, that's all the fuel there is, folks.
Yep.
And things start to go bad at that point.
The one thing that rubbed me wrong about the second episode, if memory serves, is I really didn't. I have mixed feelings about going to Talos IV.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like oh, we have a significant problem. The Talosians can fix it. Let's go there, even though it's against all the rules. On the other hand, it was fun to see the modern adaptation of those characters. I think they did a decent job with the characters, with the actors, with Vina. But it you know, even the sound effects with the vibrating flowers. You know,
I was not happy with that. I expected much more for this day and age than those vibrating flowers. I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking like a nice little Western throwback. Something, you know, something in there, but
yeah. And if you want my opinion about Vina, read my review of If Memory Serves over at thetopicistrek.com. Let's put it this way. I wasn't kind.
I like the throwback, but I just didn't. Was it necessary?
Well, that's the question, is what really was the point? I mean, if Spock could have mind melded with Burnham to show him what.
Yeah. Is that all it took to fix his craziness? I don't know.
Well, now the line that kind of gets said once and then we don't hear about it again afterwards is they talk about having to disengage Spock from logic, which, you know, you might have to go through some other thing on Vulcan to deal with that if you didn't have the Talosians. But you get the sense that, are we saying that he must still be disengaged from logic because, you know, which allows him to be a little bit more lashing out at Burnham and smile at Pike? It's not clear if they disengaged him to do something and then, you know, reset him, for lack of a better term, or is he still kind of, it sounds like he says everything has failed him. So he's now doesn't have logic and he doesn't have this and he doesn't have that. So maybe he still is disengaged from logic, which brings me to a point about, I think it was one of Gary's notes about how we think that Ethan Peck is doing in the role of Spock. It's a tough call for me because if it's true that he's supposed to be disengaged from logic, there's not a lot to go on there, right? What is Spock disengaged from logic? I mean, aside from, you know, this side of paradise or something, you know, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like you said, there are a few examples here and there of that, you know, of his displaying emotion and things like that. And I use the term, is he lacking a Nimoy-ness to his performance? Mm. You know, I thought Quinto did have that aspect about him, and maybe we just haven't had the opportunity to see enough of Peck's work to see this scope beyond this sort of damaged appearance that he's putting on for this last episode and a half. So perhaps, you know, as he actually has what I would consider meaningful dialogue, he'll, you know, we'll start to have a better sense of his take on the character.
Well, it's interesting to note that if you look at The Cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before, he is very emotional.
Yeah. Smiles.
Really, in both of these. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he gets annoyed at Kirk when Kirk wins the chess game. And then there's like kind of like, you know, deflectors at full intensity. He's just like going up, you know, like screaming. It's just like, what is going on with this guy? And so it's kind of hard to say, well, what Spock should he be kind of shifting towards? In theory, he should be shifting towards the Where No Man Has Gone Before Spock, right?
Yeah.
Right. And maybe that's their way of answering canon on that is, okay, we've got this crisis. He has to disengage from logic for a while. Emotion's going to creep in. But somehow between, you know, The Cage and it's going to come back.
Now, what do you think of the use of The Cage? You know, because we had Pike, this was inevitable. Is it pandering to say, hey, look, we are the Prime Universe? See?
I thought that was a very interesting opening to that episode.
If you want my opinion, read my review. but I'll give you that one in a nutshell. My opinion was, it was a very interesting move to do it. However, once you've done that, you now have to on screen somehow make that connection of the look of everything in what you just showed me to where you are now. Otherwise, it would be much better to just go back and say, we're going to film anew the three or four scenes we need to make this work as a previously on Star Trek with the new actors.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was an interesting move, but to me, it completely backfired that it made a disconnect in my mind, at least, that didn't need to be there. You know, I don't need to see Susan Oliver in that role and then see another actress playing Vina completely differently. You know, I don't need to see the Talosians looking one way, wearing white with this kind of head, and then suddenly they're wearing black and they've got a different kind of head. You know, it just...
Yeah, it would be like a TOS. I wonder if they were shooting for the DS9 throwback and the... Interesting. That's all I can say. Interesting. In some ways, it almost feels like a budget cut. Like, we can't afford to get the actors to film those scenes over. Let's just reuse the old footage.
Well, there's an article. I want to say it's on Trek Movie, but it might be someplace else where they were talking about the production crew was talking about doing that sequence. It wasn't part of the original story.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were kicking around the ideas about, you know, how to get into this, and it almost felt like a very last minute decision that probably the best way to do this is to just use it. And so they sunk the money, because clearly there was a lot of money spent on that. You have all these silhouettes cut out so you can have things, you know, folding over and sliding in, and you know, all sorts of things happening to make that recap work. But it sounds like it was late in the production cycle, they decided to go with it.
I also read an article that said, oh, it's so nice they're doing a sequel to The Cage. And I was thinking to myself, isn't that The Menagerie? But, anyway.
Well, it was interesting because I had to think for a minute about, let's see, I'm going to make sure I'm thinking this correctly here, that because Vina was telling Pike in the, on Discovery that there was essentially a version of Pike there.
Yeah. They were giving her a illusion of him still being there. And she's lived a lifetime with him. Like, that's not creepy at all.
Right. But did not. Okay. So, all right. So then I had to think through going, all right, well, we know that in the pilot, The Cage, Pike sees the illusionary Pike going off with Vina. However, in The Menagerie, which is the aired version, you get the impression that that is not the case, because that shot is used for Pike actually being on Talos 4.
Yep.
So for her to tell him that what they had done could come as news to him. Because at first I'm thinking, well, he would know that. He saw that. Well, if you follow really what was aired, he wouldn't know that had happened. So got to wrap your head around but that.
He wasn't surprised at all when she said that.
Yeah, because they do stuff with your head and your mind.
Right.
Before we go off of this, because we're going to move on to Warp Speed Roundtable, does anyone want to throw out a theory about who the Red Angel is? You got anything you want to toss out there? It's just a guess.
I'm not going. No. Initially, I was going to say Q, but that doesn't add up.
No, that would be. I wouldn't see it would be in his interest. I mean, you can see him mucking around with things.
Right. He's. Any theories, guys?
Yeah, I think it's an older Spock. It's not unprecedented.
Red Angel, Red Matter. Yeah, I could
see that. Exactly. That's what I was. Yeah, I was thinking. There you go.
And I think it's Burnham.
Well, there has been as people looked at the pictures, they feel that it has a feminine like silhouette. So they're assuming that it's perhaps female. So it's definitely in the realm of possibility.
And perhaps that's part of the reason why, Spock feels like he needs to have Burnham along with him, that there's something about that meld that kind of like this, I don't know, but you know, there's some sort of loneliness connection here type of thing. And, you know, so I don't know. I also wonder aloud, is the fact that the discovery in Calypso is 1,000 years in the future, we're talking about going 500 years in the future for this events, mm-hmm. does the discovery get sent 500 years after that to protect it from whatever is going to happen in the story?
Well, you know, yeah. Just to roll back to the Lights and Shadow episode, we did have that whole time travel aspect with Stamets going into the future, so to speak, or at least as he told Pike. So maybe he can pull the whole ship into the future at some point.
Right. The question is, how do they get out of there?
Slingshot around the sun.
Oh, silly me. Gonna save them whales. All right. I think that about does it. We have like 500 more things we could talk about these episodes, but we've got to move on to coin a phrase. Ain't nobody got time for that. We're going to move on and come back from our warp speed round table. So, you know, get the engines moving. We got to come back from. Yeah, that was it. That was it.
Tribbles in the engine again.
David Gerald getting back at me for the comments I was making. Anyway, we're going on to our warp speed round table. And this is. Oh. Sorry, I put my coffee cup down on the buttons, obviously. Last time around, we asked, does the character Nero... Oh, actually, there's two people we could ask you. Does the character Nero from Star Trek 2009 deserve to be given a shuttle pod or to be sent out an airlock? We did hear from a listener, from Mary Helen, and her question was, which version of Nero, or where in the plot are we talking about Nero? Are we talking about, you know, prime timeline or what? And I said, all right, for argument's sake, let's say after he gets pulled into the Kelvin timeline and then runs amok. And she said one word, airlock.
Yep.
Now we have another person here who did not get a chance to weigh in on this before. Gary.
Yes.
What do you say?
Well, geez. That actor did such a great job, but the character still sucked. Put him out the airlock. Yeah.
All right. Wow. No character is now officially.
He had 25 years to fix it. Didn't bother. Anyway.
All right. So I'm afraid that's it for our dear friend Nero. We'll give him a fiddle and I don't know. We can. Anyway. So this time around, we actually have a question from listener Ken, and Ken writes, a question about Trek. I was watching an old episode of TOS. The transporter is down. Sulu was on the surface of the planet freezing. Why didn't they just use the shuttlecraft to get Sulu? And of course, this is from the episode, The Enemy Within, where the transporter has the problem and mm-hmm. Kirk is into two. Now, the actual answer in terms of the production itself is that they hadn't built the shuttle yet. They didn't have the miniatures yet, and therefore they couldn't show the shuttle. And probably at that point, then mentioning the shuttle wasn't even anything that anyone on the team was thinking about doing because, well, we don't have that yet. So that is pretty much the true life version of why they couldn't do it.
That wouldn't stop the people I work with. They'd say, hey, we got to have this by Tuesday.
Exactly.
Voyager would make up a shuttle every episode.
Yeah. Don't worry, version 1.0 will be much better, but I'm sure we'll be fine getting Sulu up from the planet. Now, like I said, that's the official like nuts and bolts why on the episode from a production standpoint it didn't happen. But that's not good enough for the topic as Trek. So I asked all of our, all the people here to say, all right, well, what do you think the reason was that there was no shuttle going down to pick up poor freezing Sulu and the other people on the planet? And I'll start off with my explanation and then we'll go around. My explanation is that, well, they did have the shuttle, but it was new and the planet was cold and it just, you know, they might get scratched and it was new. And they didn't want to, you know, if it was nice conditions, yeah, I could see that, you know, just go down to like the pleasure planet or something and just kind of like set it down in the grass. That's great. But no, I don't, you know, it's got that new shuttlecraft smell and I don't want this thing, you know, get into an accident. So that was Kirk's explanation of why he didn't send down a shuttlecraft. But let's now ask Gary. Gary, why, I ask you, why did they not send down a shuttlecraft to pick up poor Sulu?
Well, I have two answers to give, and I'm just going to give them. The first one is Sulu was the only person qualified to fly the shuttle. And obviously they would not go against Starfleet regulations and send somebody down who was not properly trained on shuttle operations.
That's a good point, as crazy as that sounds.
Oh my.
And my second one really quick is because the writer literally did not care. Richard Matheson, who wrote that episode, only wanted the A plot having to deal with the split Kirk. He wanted no B plot at all. So he did not actually even write that part. They had some stock writer, perhaps DC Fontana or Gene Roddenberry himself, give that whole little part about Sulu freezing to death. The actual writer did not want anything to do with it and didn't write a single word of that commentary.
Right. But I mean, to your point, yeah. If they're rewriting his right, they could have thrown that in there as well as to like, well, we can't send you the shuttle because da, 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 or it doesn't operate in those temperatures or but whatever the case was to kind of get it. So yeah, I think that kind of gets back to that. Well, we weren't even thinking about the fact that there's a shuttle.
Yeah.
Like that, but we don't have the shuttle yet.
But so yeah, my in-show response is that Sulu was the only qualified pilot.
I like it.
I think that this was not a well thought out plan, Captain.
There's no one to drive.
All right. So we have these explanations. Now, Chuck, why, I ask you, he's freezing down there. He's using the phaser to heat up rocks. I mean, why will they not send something down to get these people?
I'm going with a Star Wars reference by way of Weird Al in his song Yoda when he says, I know Darth Vader's really got you annoyed, but remember if you kill him that you'll be unemployed. Okay. If they had sent the shuttle down, the show would have been over in 10 minutes. You have to stretch it out. So sending the shuttle would end the show early, and then you don't get your advertising dollars, and, you know, now you're unemployed. So it's a matter of money. We can't send the shuttle down because money.
But you still have Kirk being two people. whatever with that.
Sulu got back, the whole thing would have worked itself out.
It'll be fine. It'll be fine. Look, we've got two captains now. It'll be great. It's like my two dads.
Send one to the mirror universe. Send the other to depression therapy or something.
All right. Well, those are our explanations, both real and imagined. But you probably have some better ideas of why they didn't send a shuttle down to pick up Sulu and the gang as they're losing feelings in their fingers and their toes. Let us know.
Welcome to Wisconsin.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to July in Minnesota. But anyway, you can write in, leave a note on our Facebook page for The Topic is Trek, or you can tweet us at The Topic is Trek and tell us what your explanation is for all this leaving poor Sulu behind.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Ken. And we encourage other people to give us questions as well, because we're happy to answer them real or made up, I guess. It doesn't really matter to us what we do. All right. With that, it's about time to refill the dilithium chamber and get on out of here. So first, I want to thank our special guest star / stunt double, Gary, for joining us for this episode of The Topic is Trek.
Thank you.
And is there anything you would like to plug while you're here?
No, not at all. I'm currently on a podcast hiatus looking for new opportunities. So
what's that like?
It's a lot of book reading, but that's about it. I'm reading the Expanse series right now.
Excellent. Yeah. I have some friends that have read that, and they're trying it so hard not to give me spoilers for the show.
I heard that was like a reverse diet. Never mind.
No, it's like a thinner. Yeah, it's like it's Stephen King's Thinner and the Expanse. Put them together and just get a regular thing. But anyway,
I'll do my own crickets this time.
All right, and you get to speak on behalf of yourself and Craig, Chuck. So
you can find us still doing Technorama over at chuckchat.com/Technorama, and we are on a very irregular schedule due to personal and business reasons, but try to do that every week. You can join us live on Facebook, search for Technorama Podcast, get notifications, we're on YouTube and all the other places. All of those links are available on our website, and of course the multi-millions of things I do at work that are somewhat podcast-related, inspired by podcasts, we might say. And if you're interested in learning more about ServiceNow, have fun.
All right, time to hit the theme, boys.
That's one of these buttons. That one?
If you like the show, please be sure to tell a friend about it and subscribe so you never miss an episode. We'd love to hear from you. Follow us on Twitter at The Topic is Trek, visit our Facebook page, or visit thetopicistrek.com. Until next time, on behalf of Chuck, Gary, and myself, I'm Clinton, thanking you for listening. And as we always say here on The Topic is Trek,
Don't put on the red shirt.
And when did shuttlecrafts get transporters? I don't understand.